Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Leon Fink, who's a professor of history at the University of Illinois in Chicago. He is also edits the journal Labor Studies in Working Class History of the Americas. His books include Working Man's Democracy, The Knights of Labor and American Politics, The Mayor of Morganton, Work and Community in the Nuevo New South, and his new book just out, Sweatshops at Sea, Merchant Seamen in the World's First Globalized Industry from 1812 to the Present. Welcome to Background Briefing, Leon Fink.
Happy to be with you again.
And a happy Labor Day to you.
Thank you. Same.
And in terms of where labor stands now, the president this week is going to give a speech about jobs. Clearly, with 9.2% unemployment, the real figure is over 16% if you count people who've given up looking for work and those that are doing part-time jobs that don't really make it. It's a pretty bleak landscape in terms of labor. Where is there some hope on the horizon here? Because I don't want to depress people on this day when we should be...
While they're picnicking, that's right.
Well, also celebrating, and I think, you know, it's worth noting a lot of people probably don't have a historical sense of the achievements of labor. You know,
true.
Otherwise we'd be working. We wouldn't have a weekend. You know, labor are the people who bought you the weekend.
It does seem that sometimes we only notice labor when we can't find it, when there's no jobs to be had. And so I suppose that the good news is that it is such a center of attention now, both in politics and communities. That is, the question of employment, the question of what role does the government have in relation to the workplace, the very tumult and in many places of the country, anger about the state of rights on the job, particularly union rights in the public sector. These do suggest something of a shift in the political mood, although it's still not the dominant tone politically. But I think, you know, whereas for many years over recent decades, we could say that labor and particularly organized labor was complacent and fat and sassy. I don't think that's the case. I think it's hurt, frustrated, and angry.
And what is the explanation for this right to work phenomenon? The extent to which the South has always basically shut out labor unions. I mean, to some extent, I guess you've written about this in the Mayor of Morganton, Work and Communities in the Nuevo New South. What explains that? Because that's clearly the appeal of Rick Perry, who's running for president as a Republican and may well get the nomination. And he may well be a formidable candidate because he's saying, you know, I'm bringing jobs. I'm the Texas job miracle guy. Whether or not the jobs are worth anything is beside the point. And when you don't have a job, you know.
Yeah, to a limited extent, I think the giant sucking sound that Ross Perot talking about is low wage jobs going to places like Texas from other places. But I think that only works in a very limited fashion for specific industries that can don't choose to go abroad for this very same reason, which has happened to most of our manufacturing sector. And much of the so-called job boom in Texas is low wage jobs of immigrant labor. It's been a population boom in Texas, fueled by immigration, much of it undocumented, which of course is something that he doesn't want to talk about or have a remedy for.
Again, I'm speaking with Leon Fink, who edits the journal Labor Studies in Working Class History of the Americas. And on this Labor Day, we're talking about perhaps a renewal of labor. If the right wing can create this fiction known as the Tea Party and effectively use it as a political tool to organize and revive the right wing of the Republican Party and to capture the national agenda, Is there a possibility that of something happening in a similar way, where you have a kind of an umbrella group that's amorphous, like the Tea Party, and yet, you know, the various factions within the Tea Party, of course, on the right they tend to cooperate with each other, whereas on the left they tend to argue. But what are the chances of our previous guest mentioned, you know, the Jobs Party or something along those lines?
Well, I think that if Obama can't hold together a winning coalition in 2012 under his umbrella, and I think until that moment, it doesn't look like, you know, no one is likely to challenge him even in a symbolic way in the primaries. But if he loses, then I think there is going to be a lot of changes within this no party that we call the Democrats, because I think there are going to be some very strong, there'll definitely be populist and other currents on the left that will call for, on the one hand, new policies at the political level, but I think also within this coalition there will be more direct action at the labor front. As workers lose card check protection, if you can't have card check, which is the case now in Wisconsin with public sector workers, if you can't have card check, then you have to go back to another way of organizing people, which could prove more disruptive than the people who put in these provisions imagine. Because the only way you can organize is to prove that your organization means something, to prove that it makes a difference. And that's likely to ramp up militancy.
Explain that, if you will, to the audience, the card check provision.
Okay. Well, basically in collective bargaining, where unions are well established, a majority of workers, once organized, can put in their contracts that they'll have, that the employer will take out their union dues from their wages, so that the employer starts to do the organizing, by a form of bureaucracy, basically the money is funneled back into the union for its needs. If you in some cases, as in these right to work states, or in states with that are taking on the public unionism and making a lot of it illegitimate, the only way left then for unions or as organizations to sustain themselves, just like any other voluntary organization, is by going around and collecting dues. That means buttonholing people. That means personal contact, face-to-face organizing, which is likely only to be successful if that group is getting results. And the way you get results as a union is to stir up trouble. So I think that it's likely actually to create a less orderly workplace picture with uncertain results. But I think it's going to politicize the workplace in a way we haven't seen by effectively doing away with the more orderly but bureaucratic forms of industrial relations that we're used to.
So you think that Governor Scott Walker, when he took away collective bargaining, planned on that, or was
not at all? Because it helps him in some practical ways. It really does savage the political power of the unions, in the sense that they won't have the same treasury to work with. But it will definitely reduce the numbers overall on paper for the unions. But much of that is a passive membership to begin with, and if you make unions sort of earn their bread and butter again by face-to-face organizing, I think that has multifold impact. It doesn't just go in one way. It doesn't just go towards weakness.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Leon Fink, who is the editor of the journal Labor Studies in Working Class History of the Americas. And he's the author of a number of books, including Working Man's Democracy, The Knights of Labor and American Politics, The Mire of Morganton, Working Community in the Nuevo New South, and his new book just out, Sweatshops of Sea, Merchant Seamen in the World's First Globalized Industry from 1812 to the Present. Why don't we just take a brief station break here, Leon,
sure.
and we'll be back sure. continuing the conversation in a moment. Bring me my boots and shoes. You can hang back or fight your best on the front line. Sing a little bit of these working bands. Sailing on back, ready for the long haul, tossed by the winds and the seas. I'll drag them all down. Tell all you fascists, you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized to bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Race hatred cannot stop us. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And I'm speaking with Leon Fink, who's a professor of history at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He edits the journal Labor, Studies in Working Class History of the Americas, and his books include Working Man's Democracy, The Knights of Labor and American Politics, The Mire of Morganton, Work and Community in the Nuevo New South, and his new book, Sweatshops at Sea, Merchant Seamen in the World's First Globalized Industry from 1812 to the present. And in terms of reviving labor before the scenario that you were talking about earlier suggests that if President Obama doesn't revive the coalition, and obviously he's going to probably he's already disillusioned a lot of the progressives, and I imagine he's going to disillusion the environmentalists by authorizing this tar sands pipeline, which I suspect will happen, given that he's already caved in on the Clean Air Act. If he is defeated, and let me ask you this: is there anything that can be done in reviving the progressive movement without the president leading? In other words, pushing him. If the Tea Party can invade the Republican Party and capture it, why can't a bunch of angry progressives get together and capture the Democratic Party and capture the agenda and sweep out the Wall Streeters force their political representatives to represent them?
Well, I think it's a learning process, Ian, that has yet to find its it's appropriate strategy. I think we saw masses of people in Wisconsin that virtually turned the state upside down, although then they sort of backpedaled into an electoral strategy that came close but didn't quite bring home the bacon in terms of the recall. It does show there's an angry political crowd out there, potentially potent at the political level. But I think we're still, in terms of strategy and tactics, have yet to find the appropriate one. I'm thinking of the movements that we've seen in other parts of the world, where whether it's the so-called Arab Spring or the movement of Anna Hazari in India, where one person can galvanize dramatic popular support with, in this case, nonviolent fast. We haven't seen from the ranks of labor any really imaginative street tactics, nonviolent mass protest, for a long time, really since probably Cesar Chavez. We haven't had a powerful leader emerge, someone who's willing to go outside of bureaucratic constraints to really ask for popular support and to bring people out in any sustained way for years, really since the labor civil rights coalition.
So, I hate to be a broken record here, but a part of my political understanding is that there's a kind of Pavlovian nature to politics, where there has to be sufficient pain before there's sufficient gain. In other words, when we really we are, I think, in a heading back into a double dip recession. But is it going to require a depression to galvanize the majority of people in this country to question the idea of the American dream, to demand that tens of millions plus
out of work? That's a lot of people. They don't. What more of a depression do we need? I think what we lack so far is we don't have an unemployment movement. I mean, in the 30s, there were rent parties, there were refusals to allow evictions. We haven't come up with the strategy or tactics to touch the people who are suffering, or to give them hope that there's a real alternative. And I think we often hear from the labor movement, from the progressives generally in this country, that labor rights are human rights. But until people believe that and are willing to act on those rights in the same way that they took seriously civil rights, something worth sacrificing for, something worth maybe going to jail for, then I don't think until that test has been made, we don't know what the potential is for a true popular response.
But Leon Fink, as a labor historian, how do you explain how quickly the country has changed? If you see President Roosevelt's State of the Union address in 1944, where he called for a second Bill of Rights, where he called for health care, job security, a living wage, call for the end of monopolies. I mean, it's an amazing, it's breathtaking. Yes. To think that was on the agenda back then, and that wasn't so long ago. And now you have these people like Grover Norquist, funded by the Koch brothers and all of these other bilious billionaires, talking about shrinking government down to the size you can drown it in a bathtub. And of course, that's a lie, because government got bigger under George W. Bush. But the truth of the matter is this is a form of right-wing welfare. What the Republicans do is they create a system of where you loot the government, where private public money is transferred into private hands. So
That's true, but haven't those people always been around in one form or another? Don't we have to expect that kind of message is going to be out there, and that's even going to be well-funded? I think the question is what alternative is being posed to them. I mean, we can't shrink from the challenge of the right. I mean, they're willing to take the country back really before the progressive era, not only before the New Deal, but what's the alternative really being posed to them? I think part of the reason that there aren't maybe angry people in the streets or surrounding the White House is that we have had we have humanized capitalism in this country to a degree, and we do offer some fallback protection, some shreds of a safe. There is something of a safety net and extended unemployment compensation in some of the welfare programs that the country has. But surely that's shredding in the past years, and surely that's inadequate for the needs of people as schools close, teachers are laid off, as people lose their housing. Surely there's tinder for another vision, a more energized response to the changing nature of global capitalism.
But what happened, though, to that enormous legacy and majority in that earlier generation, the one that is called the greatest generation, that supported this president, who called for this second Bill of Rights, to call for stuff that other, by the way, other social democracies have? This would be a very different America today if those things were implemented. any of them for that matter, you know.
I do agree, but I think that there, in terms of what happened to the specific message, one of the things that did happen was the post-war boom, so that a lot of three decades of people generally doing pretty well, even without an expansive new programmatic vision, that is public policy. There was just a greater pie, and people ate it, got a piece of it. But then that pie froze or has been diminished, and we go back to the state of public programs, basically, as you're saying, at the end of the New Deal with a few tinkerings since. But there's been no gust of wind behind the backs of a more progressive social vision since that time.
So how do you explain then the fact that the progressive movement has its real victories since FDR have been the Civil Rights Act and in effect, and the anti-war movement at the end of the Vietnam War, but it seems those successes seem to be at a cultural level, and all of that anti-war activity, as soon as Nixon ended the Vietnam War, that as a political movement, a powerful political movement, it just dissipated. So, I don't understand how you.
Well, I think civil rights, the feminist movement, environmentalism, and there was a lot of unfinished business. The very nature of the workforce and the working class has dramatically changed, even since Jeff Cowie's 1970s, and not to mention the hammer blow that people have not figured out how to respond to of globalization of the total transformation of the of production. Across the world, I just think it's partly taken time to catch up to these changes. But I don't think that people had totally fallen asleep. But I think that there has not been the same coalition can't carry the day now that carried it then. It has to be a new coalition, and it has to include. I mean, among the people who it has to include is an immigrant labor force, some of whom, unfortunately, don't have even the most basic political rights.
Well, wouldn't it seem, though, Leon Fink, that that we need a little bit of honesty here and less sort of jingoism and false patriotism and a real examination of the nature of the American dream, the nature of a social contract. What is our birthright here as Americans? Are we exceptional in any way? When right next door you have a country, Canada, that has a high standard of living, all kinds of benefits that they get for their tax dollars, and we have none of those. I mean, why not have a real examination of the American dream and do a real accounting of what it is, you know, what does it mean to be an American? Just cutting aside all of the patriotic jingoism and getting down to the nitty gritty and painting a real picture.
I think all for the good, Ian. I think that Americans, I'll give even the popular culture credit for being more cosmopolitan, despite, you know, some twinges of old style jingoism and xenophobia. But I think overall, it's a more multicultural country and political culture. I think even the support for it's a more tolerant place than it has been before. I think it's ready to look for answers outside of our borders as well. I don't think that the fact that socialized medicine is Canadian or is French or German, I don't think those arguments play so well anymore. So I don't think that's really the problem, is that people are just falling, that the right can just fall back on an idiot Americanism. I don't see that quite as the problem.
Well, do you think, though, that that there is some traction in the idea of fairness and the disparity of wealth growing in this country, and the idea that billionaires, the Republican Party's gone to the mat for billionaires? For God's sake, please don't tax them anymore, even though they're doing better than ever, and that the poor have to maintain the burden of and deal with this debt. So the very people who ran up the debt, who the taxpayer then made whole through the TARP payoff, now are immune from any social responsibility. They're sitting pretty, and the rest of us have to service this debt.
I just think people want something very tangible. I don't think it's that they're afraid of something radical, but it has to be something that they can see almost immediately having some positive effect. I mean, much of the Obama's health care benefits don't even take effect till 2014, so people don't even see the people who are covered by insurance don't even see that yet, because they don't really have it yet. But the same way would have been, imagine if he'd moved dramatically at a crucial moment to nationalize the banks, as is in the case in France, and then used the government influence over banks to actually change mortgage policies to stave off this whole foreclosure crisis in a tangible way. I mean, that would make a difference. So would a jobs program that immediately puts, you know, potentially millions of people to work. I think there would be support for that, actually.
Well, there's evidence that one of the states with the best economy and the lowest unemployment, North Dakota, has a state bank, and that community banks seem to be the best way around Wall Street, and it's how banking used to be before the big banks took over and took all of that money that used to be recycled back into the community. Now it goes directly into their pockets and into speculation. Well, I thank you for joining us here.
Ian, it was a pleasure. Let's make Labor Day something memorable this time.
Well, I thank you for joining us, okay. Leon Fink.
Bye.
Again, I've been speaking with Leon Fink, who is a professor of history at the University of Illinois in Chicago. He edits the journal Labor, Studies in Working Class History of the Americas. His books include Working Man's Democracy, The Knights of Labor in American Politics, The Mire of Morganton, Working Community in the Nuevo New South, and his new book, Sweatshops at Sea, Merchant Seamen in the World's First Globalized Industry from 1812 to the Present. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.